Today, Decoding the Future, the DFA Daily to the 9th of September 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a little philosophy on the side. We're seeing a cacophony of voices calling on one hand for more stimulus to assist the economy, whilst on the other arguing the property market is doing fine and we should open migration to support prices. The battle continues. The Grattan Institute, for example, has urged Australia's various governments to loosen the purse strings and to spend big to see Australia pass the COVID-19 recession. Commonwealth has spent almost 9% of national output on stimulus, whereas they say no state except Tasmania has spent more than 2% of its own output. The two biggest states, New South Wales and Victoria, have each spent little more than 1%, but these measures tell only part of the story, they say. The Commonwealth has greater spending power because it has more revenue to draw from, and the states get about half their revenue from the Commonwealth. Excluding what it passes on to the states, the Commonwealth's revenue is, as a share of gross domestic product, about twice that of most states as a share of gross state product. Yet its COVID response has been almost six times as big. Although the Commonwealth is the main funder for several of the traditional stimulus levers, including the welfare and personal income tax systems, the states also spend money in areas that can be used to stimulate the economy. The most important includes social housing, health, education, and industry support. And there's also plenty of room to move on state government balance sheets. All six states entered the crisis with net debt below 15% of gross state product and with interest and depreciation costs less than 2% of gross state product. All were projecting operating expenses. Their borrowing costs, though higher than the Commonwealth's, are still exceptionally low. New South Wales and Victoria can borrow for 10 years at an interest rate of just over 1%, far below the Reserve Bank's inflation target band, making the money free in real terms. More is needed from both, of course. All of this suggests our states, they say, can and should do more to support the recovery, but the Commonwealth will also need to do more. Like the states, it has room to spend more, and it should. The Reserve Bank expects unemployment to peak at 10% in the December quarter and still be as high as 7% in December 2022. That's too high for too long. So to avoid this scenario, the Grattan Institute recommended in June that the governments of both kinds plan for $70 to $90 billion in extra stimulus over the next 2 years to bring unemployment down to 5% sooner and to get wages growing again. The renewed economic fallout from stage four restrictions in Melbourne means that the response will now need to be even larger. And there is a banquet of worthwhile options governments should be considering, and they shouldn't fight over who picks up the tab. If governments of both kinds don't do more, the recession will be longer. Maybe, they say, maybe it wouldn't hurt to make a little whoopee. The downside of doing too little way exceeds the potential downside of doing too much. And the AFR reported yesterday that this is how it might be engineered. Banks will be directed by financial regulators to buy up to $240 billion of additional federal and state government debt to normalise emergency bank liquidity in a regulatory move that will lower government borrowing costs and encourage stimulus spending on infrastructure and other programmes. The primary objective of the yet-to-be-announced shift by the Australian Prudential Regulator Authority and the Reserve Bank of Australia will be to enhance bank stability in line with international rules, so banks continue to withstand periods of financial stress. But a consequence and second-order goal of the financial policy shake-up will be lower Commonwealth and state government interest rates as banks buy more government bonds instead of holding private sector bank bonds and residential mortgage-backed securities. The adjustments would help governments, particularly states, fulfill RBA Governor Phil Lowe's pleas to seize on ultra-low interest rates to fund job-creating programs such as infrastructure projects. Bankers have been in discussion with APRA about the looming change that is expected to be unveiled after the October federal budget, when the Commonwealth's debt projection is updated to about $1 trillion, according to the AFR. And meanwhile, the SMH reported that ANZ Bank Chief Executive Shane Elliott says the lender is preparing to deal with a much larger number of financially distressed customers next year as government support fades, though ultra-low interest rates will give struggling borrowers more time. And ANZ Group Executive for Australian Retail and Commercial Banking, Mark Hand, said the bank was planning on the assumption that more businesses would need to assess their viability before the Christmas trading period, with the bank forecasting house price falls of up to 15%. Mr. Hand was asked if this meant ANZ would limit loan-to-valuation ratios in Melbourne, and he responded that the 15% fall forecast was a worst-case scenario, but it would impose LVR limits on some postcodes, and there were parts of the country where it would not lend more than 80% of a property's sale price. And he said that for some luxury properties, it would limit LVRs on new loans to 70%. And after the Victorian state government on Sunday extended its lockdown of Melbourne by 2 weeks, Jefferies banking analyst Brian Johnson said this was another setback for the economy. Mr. Johnson predicted a fairly hefty rise in the bank's bad debt provisions and said deferring loans in the long term would slow down growth. It's a horrible position to be in. Deferring a home loan might ease the initial pain, but it slows down future growth and perhaps you end up having an economy that looks like a bit of a zombie, Mr. Johnson said. Meanwhile, Bell Potter analyst T.S. Lim said the last thing banks wanted to do was to foreclose, but added that markets were expecting substantially higher bad debt provisions from the Australian banks. I think probably the worst has been priced in. All the analysts have a lot of bad debts coming through from now until next year, he said. Yet, CBA has just revised down its peak-to-trough property price falls. Their top-down modelling points now to price falls by only 0.6% a month over the remainder of 2020, and their bottom-up approach by Capital City suggests a similar outcome. So they therefore expect national dwelling prices to be down by about 1.8% over the year to December 2020, implying a 5% fall in prices from April 2020, and they've penciled in a further small fall in the first quarter of 2021, which takes the total peak to trough of around 6%. From there, their central scenario is for a stabilisation in prices before a solid recovery from the second half of 21 up 3% over 6 months, or an annualised pace of around 6%. The RBA cuts to the cash rate in 2019 and 2020 that took mortgage rates to record lows are the main reason why dwelling prices nationally have not fallen all that much, considering the huge negative shock to the economy, they said. As the economy recovers and the headwinds of rising unemployment and falling rents dissipate, they believe the borrowing costs will once again become the dominant driver of dwelling prices. And the RBA has tended to play down the influence of monetary policy decisions on dwelling prices, but, they said, we believe that changes in interest rates are the single most important driver of real property prices over the long run. My sidebar there, no, it's credit availability, not interest rates alone. The relationship between dwelling prices and monetary policy is quite straightforward, they say. Lower, higher interest rates essentially mean that for a given level of income, a borrower can service a bigger or smaller mortgage, all else equal. That means that lower or higher interest rates put upward or downward pressure on the demand for credit and therefore dwelling prices. And they said, we saw the profound impact the RBA rate cuts had on the property market as recently as last year. The housing market was reignited following three 25 basis point cuts to the cash rate in June July and October 2019, and prices rose briskly until the pandemic arrived. Importantly, low interest rates don't just have an impact on housing prices because households can borrow more for a given level of income. They also increase the attractiveness of property from an investment perspective because the yield on property is compared to the risk-free rate, i.e. the term deposit rate for households. It's a similar story for equities, whereby lower interest rates push up equity prices, all else equal. Put another way, lower interest rates increase the demand for dwellings for both owner-occupiers and investors, and they influence the price at which buyers and sellers will transact. And they went on to say, back in April, we wrote the following. There are both downside and upside risks to our dwelling price forecast. The risks both hinge on the length of the enforced shutdown and the restrictions placed on economic activity. In a best-case scenario, government restrictions on economic activity could start to be lifted by the end of May. For that to occur, it would probably take several days of zero or very low community transmission of new COVID-19 cases. That is a possible scenario given the current trend in new COVID-19 cases. If that were to occur, the plunge in economic activity that we expect would not be as large, and the impact on the property market would not be as severe. Indeed, the fall in property prices would be significantly smaller than our central scenario, particularly given the extraordinary low borrowing rates currently on offer. There are scenarios, however, that are significantly worse than our central scenario. If restrictions are eased in the third quarter 20, as we expect, but a second round of COVID-19 new cases emerge, then both the economy and housing market would be adversely impacted. We would see restrictions return, but the hit this time on the economy and the labour market would be more significant, and the damage would be longer lasting. Falls in dwelling prices far greater than our central scenario would be plausible. We believe that policymakers will be acutely aware of the risks of this scenario, and as a result, they will take a cautious approach to reopening the economy. And they said, as it turns out, both risks essentially materialised. The best case scenario happened in all states other than Victoria, where the downside scenario materialised. Relative to our updated forecast, they say, the risks are skewed to the downside. Any imposition of restrictions would likely see prices fall more than our central scenario, which is based on no further lockdowns and a recovery in national economic activity from the fourth quarter 2020. In the meantime, the ABS revealed that the mortgage flows for July were up 8.9%, and that was far bigger than the consensus forecast of just up 2%. Owner-occupied mortgages surged 10.7%, and investor mortgages were up 3.5%. There have been strong rises across owner-occupied housing purposes in June and July, highlighted by a sharp increase in loan commitments for the purchase of residential land. July's rise in owner-occupiers was seen across all states and territories apart from the ACT, which remained relatively steady, while New South Wales, Western Australia and South Australia displayed rises for investors in July, Victoria. Year on year, total new mortgage commitments, excluding refinancing, rose by 11.8%, with owner-occupier mortgages surging by 18.5%. But investor mortgages fell 5.1%. First home buyer mortgages surged 10.6% in July, with their share of total mortgages at 22.4%, the equal highest level since the global financial crisis. If it continues over the next few months, it will point to stabilisation and then recovery of the housing market. But this data partially predates the virus resurgence in Victoria and subsequent escalating shutdowns. It also doesn't take into account the unwinding of emergency income support, mortgage repayment deferrals, and other factors that will hit later this year and early into 2021. But predictably, the HIA were quick on the draw. Housing finance figures released today, they say, show that lending for the construction of a new home rose in July for the first time since February to the highest level in 2 years. Not only does this data show that there has been an increase in the number of loans for the construction of a new home, there was also an increase in the purchase of new and established homes. And they went on to say, there has been a tangible improvement in sentiment and confidence in the housing market. Most significant today's data shows that there has been a 30% increase in the number of loans issued for the purchase of residential land for the second month in a row. Financials approved for the purchase of a block of land are now 69.9% higher than in the same month last year. This is the first indication of the impact of home builder, they say. One of the early decisions-making stages of building a new home is the purchase of a suitable block of land. The surge in land sales should see a recovery in the number of slabs being poured as early as the December quarter as customers proceed through the process to design and construct a new home. This will protect employment in the residential building industry and across the economy into 2021. This sudden increase in demand for residential land was experienced across all states, they said. The surge in lending for land purchases highlights a risk that the availability of residential lots where on-site work can begin within the time frame of the home builder package could limit uptake under the scheme. Across the states, the number of loans to own occupiers for the purchase of residential land in July increased across all jurisdictions compared to July 2019. The largest increase was recorded in Queensland, up 145.1%, followed by Western Australia, up 110%, South Australia at 105%, Tasmania up 100%, New South Wales up 65%, and Victoria up 35.3%. So it's worth noting that the two biggest states has the smallest rise. And according to realestate.com.au, dwindling migration is set to drag Australian population growth to a 103-year low, with potentially disastrous results for the housing market. Property research group CoreLogic warned the slowdown would have an impact on construction, rents and off-the-plan apartment sales. Group head of research Tim Lawless said the construction sector was particularly exposed. Lower migration could have the added effect of causing a protracted drop in rents within inner city areas, considering overseas arrivals normally make up a large share of the tenants. Falls in rents could also force down prices, as there would be fewer investors willing to purchase units they may struggle to tenant. This would increase settlement risk for buyers of units sold off the plan, a situation where the value of a property drops below the purchase price in the time it takes to get built. Nearly 85% of overseas migration last year flowed into capital cities, and 3/4 of that movement went to Sydney and Melbourne. The impact of the sharp fall in overseas arrivals can already be seen in surging inner city rental advertisements, with rental listings more than doubling across some key inner city unit precincts. The rise in availability of rental stock in these precincts is already weighing on rental income, he said. Every capital city is showing a large fall in unit rents relative to house rents through the COVID period to date, with a more significant difference in Melbourne and Sydney. With rents reducing the ability of landlords to service their mortgages, there could be more distressed listings within inner Sydney and Melbourne. Many of the aforementioned inner city precincts are toward the end of a surge in new apartment supply. Many of these yet-to-be-completed projects will settle while rental vacancies remain high and rents are falling, which may put further downward pressure on property values. And the ABS building activity data showed that there were more than 50,000 units under construction across New South Wales at the end of March and just over 45,000 across Victoria. And Mr. Lawless concluded that lower population growth would affect the market for some time. So here you can see some of the tussles. A lot of people are arguing for migration to support property prices. And of course, low interest rates will support property prices. And yet, on the other hand, you've still got all the issues relating to the virus and the very weak outlook for employment ahead, very little income growth, and significant pressure on many households. So it is a very complicated situation. And of course, all of the sectors are talking their own book. But I think the truth is, if you stand back, there are probably more down forces than up forces at the moment, which is why I still maintain my view that property prices will be lower over the next couple of years compared with now. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.